Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Phil Dierking, Lucia Malonig, and Betty Azar. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Phil Dierking.
Top Trump administration officials say they are not the writer of a New York Times opinion piece sharply critical of President Donald Trump. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke on the issue during his visit to India. He called the opinion piece sad. He criticized the media for what he said were its efforts to undermine this administration. Vice President Mike Pence also denied writing the opinion piece. His deputy chief of staff said Pence's office is above such amateur acts. The director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, released a statement denying that he or his top deputy wrote the piece. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin also issued denials. The Times said the writer is a senior administration official whose job would be at risk if the person's identity were to be made public. The opinion piece says that Trump's staff often takes action to block the president from action. The writer of the piece says he or she wants Americans to know that there are adults in the room. The writer describes the president as impetuous, adversarial, petty, and ineffective.
Trump was asked about the piece on Wednesday following an event at the White House. He called it gutless and launched into an extended criticism of the newspaper. They don't like Donald Trump, and I don't like them because they're very dishonest people, the president told reporters. Trump described the writer of the opinion piece as someone probably who is failing and probably here for all the wrong reasons.
The piece says administration officials have discussed the possible use of the 25th Amendment. That measure defines methods to legally remove a president from office. However, the writer says no one wants to cause a constitutional crisis. The piece reports, "So we will do what we can to steer the administration in the right direction until, one way or another, it's over."
The opinion piece in the New York Times is similar to parts of a new book about Trump by reporter Bob Woodward. Short parts of Fear, Trump in the White House were published Tuesday in the Washington Post. The book is set for release next Tuesday. Trump called Woodward's new work fiction. I'm Lucia Malonig.
And I'm Phil Dierking.
For VOA Learning English, this is Everyday Grammar. Today, we have a special guest host. Betty Azar is the most successful writer of grammar textbooks in the world. Generations of English learners will recognize her best-selling book, Understanding and Using English Grammar. The famous Blue Grammar book, now in its fourth edition, is in use at language schools across the world. Ms. Azar also supports research and professional development in the English language teaching field. Today, Ms. Azar will offer some advice on how to hear the sounds of grammar.
English speakers talk too fast. I can't understand what they're saying.
Does that sound familiar? It's a common complaint of English language learners, one I've heard often from my university-level ESL students through the years. Normal contracted speech, especially in everyday conversational usage, can speed by like a bullet train. It can leave learners feeling a little dazed as they try to catch the meaning. For most adult learners, reading is, of course, much easier to understand. When understanding English is just between you and the written page, you can go as slowly as you want. You can go back and read words again, perhaps break down the grammar. You can even leisurely look up the meaning of a word. And at least in writing, there are spaces between words. If only that were true in speaking. If only speakers paused briefly between words, it would be so much easier for learners. Teachers in second language classes often speak slowly and distinctly, as I am doing now. But in the real world, well, it's not going to happen. Or, to say that in normal contracted speech, well, it's not going to happen. Speakers squeeze sounds together, or drop sounds, or say them so softly and quickly that a listener can barely hear them. When you listen to my sentence again, notice that the T is almost completely dropped from its, and going to becomes gonna. Well, it's not gonna happen. As a teacher, I've often heard students say things like, "Bye, I leaving now, I see you tomorrow." What's missing? The grammar sounds are missing. In this case, the M and L sounds for am and will. Listen for them in the corrected sentences. "Bye, I'm leaving now, I'll see you tomorrow." The M and L sounds are barely said aloud, but a native speaker hears them, do you? Listen again. "Bye, I'm leaving now, I'll see you tomorrow." And then, sometimes, native speakers drop not only sounds, but complete words. Listen to this. "Bye, leaving now, see you tomorrow." If you're saying "not fair," you're not the first English learner to feel that way. Grammar students learn that am is are and helping verbs, for example, will, have, would, are often contracted with pronouns in both speaking and writing, as in I'm and I'll. But most students also find it helpful to know that in everyday spoken English, these verbs are usually contracted with nouns and question words, too. Here's a sentence about a man named Tom. Tom is a noun. In writing, you will see, "Don't worry, Tom will be here soon." In speaking, you will hear, "Don't worry, Tom will be here soon." Listen for "Tom will" again. "Don't worry, Tom will be here soon." Here's another example of a contraction with a noun. "My book is on the table becomes my book's on the table. And another example, this time with are. In writing, you will see my books are on the table. In speaking, you will hear my books are on the table. Again, my books are on the table. The verb sounds are so quick that it's almost impossible to hear them unless you expect to hear them. Listen again. My book's on the table. My books are on the table. Question words, such as where, when, why, are similarly contracted in speech. In writing, each word is separate. For example, where are the students? Where have they gone? In spoken English, the question word is contracted with the verb. Where are the students? Where have they gone? Again, where are the students? Where have they gone? No wonder it's hard for learners to catch these grammar sounds. If you think English speakers talk really fast, you're right, they do. Do and did are also often reduced. Listen for do you. Do you know Mrs. Lee? Again, do you know Mrs. Lee? Did can be a quick D sound when it's combined with a question word. Listen for where did and what did. Where'd she go? What'd she do? Again, where'd she go? What'd she do? Here's another example of shortened spoken English that my students usually enjoy. Two people are talking. Gdzie? No, gdzie? In other words, spoken slowly, did you eat yet? No, did you? Did is a good example of a function word. A function word gives grammar information. In the sentence, did you eat yet? Did tells us that the speaker is talking about the past and is asking a question. In contrast, eat is a content word. So are words such as Tom, yesterday, lunch. Content words have specific meanings. Function words are the ones that are the hardest to hear in speech. Content words are usually said more clearly and loudly. Along with helping verbs, other common function words are and, to, the, and a. Let's look at and. And shows the relationship between two nouns. Bob and Tom tells us there are two people. Like most function words, and is usually reduced. I had lunch with Bob and Tom yesterday. A learner could easily think that Bob and Tom is one word. To is usually reduced to a slight T sound. Let's ask Tom to come with us sounds like, let's ask Tom to come with us. Again, let's ask Tom to come with us. The and a can be especially hard for learners to hear. Listen for the and a. In class yesterday, I asked the teacher a question. Even if you know the and a are supposed to be there, you have to listen hard to hear them. Listen again. In class yesterday, I asked the teacher a question. Native speakers can hear the softer sounds of function words, but it can be very difficult for second language learners to hear them. Knowing some grammar can help. For example, learners are more likely to hear and to say, "By I'm leaving now, I'll see you later," if they are familiar with the forms and meanings of verb tenses. If learners don't know what grammar sounds they're supposed to hear, chances are they won't hear them. If they don't hear them, chances are they won't include them in their own speaking and writing. In other words, an awareness of grammar can prepare you to understand what you're hearing, and hearing the sounds of grammar can, in turn, help you use English more accurately. I'm Betty Azar.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
The presidential race looks jar-lid tight. We could be in for a long night as voters decide whether Vice President Al Gore or Texas Governor George Bush will be the next president of the United States. It is that close.
In 2000, Americans were preparing to elect a new president in November. The United States Constitution limits presidents to two terms. Bill Clinton would be leaving office, so his Democratic Party needed to choose a new candidate. The Democrats nominated Clinton's vice president, Al Gore. Gore chose Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut as his running mate. Lieberman became the first Jewish candidate ever nominated by a major party to such a high office. He was first elected to the Senate in 1988. Al Gore was born in Washington in 1948. He was named after his father, a United States Senator from Tennessee. The future vice president grew up in Washington and in Carthage, Tennessee, where his family had a farm. He studied government at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and graduated in 1969. That was during the Vietnam War. His father opposed American involvement in that war. But the young Al Gore joined the army and spent about 6 months of his service as a military journalist in Vietnam. Back in civilian life, Gore again worked as a reporter. Later, he studied religion and then law at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. But he dropped out of law school to enter politics. He was elected to the United States House of Representatives in 1976. He became known for supporting nuclear arms control and protecting the environment. Al Gore was elected to the Senate in 1984. He was re-elected 6 years later. That was after he had tried to become the Democratic candidate for president in 1988. Then, in 1992, Bill Clinton won the party's nomination and asked Al Gore to be his vice president. As vice president, Gore became known for his work on issues involving the environment, technology, and foreign relations. In March 1999, he gave an interview on CNN. During that interview, he talked about his plans to enter the race for the presidential nomination the following year. He made the statement that during his service in Congress,
I took the initiative in creating the Internet.
He went on to say that he took the initiative in moving forward other efforts important to the economy, environmental protection, and educational improvements. But his comment about the Internet led to jokes and criticism that he was claiming to have actually invented it. The Republicans nominated Texas Governor George W. Bush as their presidential candidate. For his running mate, he chose Dick Cheney, a former Secretary of Defense. George Walker Bush was born in Texas in 1946, the oldest child of former President George Herbert Walker Bush. He grew up in the Texas cities of Midland and Houston. He graduated from Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, and earned a master's in business administration at Harvard University. During the Vietnam War years, he was a pilot in the Texas Air National Guard. Later, he worked in the state's oil and gas industry. In 1988, Bush worked on his father's winning campaign for president. Later, he became one of the owners of the Texas Rangers, a Major League Baseball team. In 1994, George W. Bush was elected governor of Texas. He was re-elected 4 years later. Several other candidates also ran for president in the November 2000 election. These minor, or so-called third-party candidates, included activist Ralph Nader. He represented the Green Party. He criticized large corporations for having too much influence in America. Pat Buchanan, a conservative, ran as the Reform Party candidate. Public opinion surveys showed that the race between George Bush and Al Gore would be extremely close. The election took place on November 7th. More than 100 million people voted for them. Al Gore received about 540,000 more of those votes than George Bush did. But winning the popular vote does not make someone president. Americans do not directly elect their president. When they vote for a candidate, what they are really doing is voting for electors. The number of electors for each state is based on the size of its congressional delegation, which is based on population. These electors then vote in December in a system known as the Electoral College. The Electoral College officially elects the president. In the 2000 election, there were 538 electors in the Electoral College. To become president, the winner needed a simple majority of 270. Al Gore won the popular vote, but neither he nor George Bush won a majority of the electoral votes. Not that any of this was clear on election night.
Bulletin, Florida pulled back into the undecided column. This thing is so wild, wacky, and woolly, nobody knows how it's going
to
come out.
CNN right now is moving Florida to the too close to call column.
Too close to call.
Florida is now too close to call. I want to say that again. It's a confusing situation. Now, if you're disgusted with us, frankly, I don't blame you.
Florida is a big southern state. It had enough electoral votes to make either candidate the winner. Election officials counted almost 6 million votes on election night. George Bush had slightly more votes than Al Gore, but not enough to avoid a recount. Florida state law calls for a recount when the difference between two candidates is less than one-half of 1% of the votes. State recounts normally involve the governor, but the governor of Florida said he would not get involved. That was because the governor was Jeb Bush, George Bush's brother. And there were other issues with the election. Some black voters said election workers had unjustly prevented them from voting.
there were also problems with voting machines and ballots. In one area, some Gore supporters believed they had voted for Pat Buchanan by mistake. The names were next to one another on the ballot. Democrats said the ballot design was illegal. Republicans said Democratic Party officials had never objected to it. The disputed election results in Florida introduced a new term into popular speech. Americans began talking about chads. Whether it was hanging chads, pregnant chads, or dimpled chads, it amounted to the same problem. It meant that a voting machine had not cleanly punched out a bit of paper called a chad when the voter made a choice. As a result, the ballot would confuse a vote-counting machine and make the choice unreadable. That, in turn, meant election workers had to look at each questionable ballot and try to decide the voter's choice. All this took place with the nation and the world watching and wondering who would become America's next president. Something else only added to anger and debate over the situation in Florida. Florida's Secretary of State, its chief election officer, Catherine Harris, also happened to be a leader of the Bush campaign there.
Governor George W. Bush, 2,912,790.
Almost 3 weeks after the election, Florida officials declared George Bush the winner of the state's 25 electoral votes. That gave him a total of 271. Out of 6 million ballots, state officials said he had defeated Al Gore by 537 votes. But the election was still not over. Gore and his supporters in Florida asked the courts to reject the results because of what they said were the many voting problems. The Florida Supreme Court ordered another count of the disputed ballots. Bush campaign officials quickly appealed to the United States Supreme Court. The court said Florida law did not explain how officials should judge the ballots. The court found the situation in Florida unconstitutional because there were different standards around the state. The justices also said not enough time remained to settle the issue before the Electoral College had to meet. On December 12th, the court voted 7-2 to end the recount and 5-4 against ordering a new one. 6 days later, on December 18th, members of the Electoral College met in each state capital and the District of Columbia. They made the election official. George W. Bush would become the 43rd President of the United States.
I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
He took office on January 20th, 2001. The election dispute had divided Americans. But less than a year later, the nation was brought together by events that would set the direction for the presidency of George W. Bush.
A plane has just crashed into the World Trade Center here in New York City. It happened just a few moments ago.
The United States suffered the worst terrorist attacks in its history on September 11th, 2001, a day that would be remembered as 9/11.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.